Hi, Wanju. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Curb Podcast. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and this is the podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and curators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. Let's take a moment to look ahead to the films of 2025 from Australian cinema, and a couple of the ones that will probably get some people talking. Two particular films had their world premiere at the Adelaide Film Festival in 2024, where the lead actor and performer, Albert Mwangi, was in attendance. Kate Blackmore's Make It Look Real is one of them. It's a hybrid documentary experience that explores the role of intimacy coordination on film sets, and Albert features in the documentary as himself. He also features in the film within a film as a character in Kieran Darcy Smith's romantic thriller, Tightrope, a manufactured film for the experience of the documentary. Make It Look Real is a captivating and conversation-starting film about how intimacy coordination has been presented on screen and how it can be safely depicted for all actors involved. Albert's other film that premiered at the Adelaide Film Festival was Kelly Schilling's With or Without You, where he plays Dalu, a migrant worker swept into the lives of Melina Vidler's Chloe and her alcoholic mother Sharon, played with effortless abandon by Marta Dusseldorp. With both of these films, Albert holds the audience's focus keenly, asking us to lean in to find out more about his performances. This level of captivation is partly the reason why he was nominated for the Casting Guild of Australia's Rising Star list in 2021. In the following interview, Albert talks about the balance of working on stage and screen, how he manages his creative journey as a storyteller and as a vessel for other stories, and where he would like to see his career progress after these two films. Both Make It Look Real and With or Without You do not have announced dates at this stage, but keep an eye out for them as they make their way around Australia in 2025. Right, if you want to find out more about what we do on The Curb, then please head over to thecurb.com.au. We are a completely independent and ad-free website that lives on the support of listeners and readers just like yourself. If you can and you have the means to support us, please visit patreon.com/thecurbau to support our work from as little as $1 a month. Before my interview with Albert, I'm just going to play you a short clip from his performance as Hamlet, as done with NIDA, and I'll put a link to the full clip in the show notes as well.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. To die, to sleep, no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep. To sleep perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause.
I'd love to hear about where your interest and, you know, drive to become an actor started.
Oh, amazing. I feel like it's always been there from like my childhood. I attribute that to my parents loving watching film and my siblings as well. We've kind of always literally sat down having dinner, like, together in front of a TV watching film, and we used to borrow a lot of like cassette tapes. We had like in Kenya, back home in Kenya, we had these stores where you could, you know, borrow cassette tapes. It was kind of like the Blockbuster of Kenya at that time. And we'd borrow all these tapes and watch TV shows and films, and it literally was just a family cultural thing that we do. And then when we could afford it after some time, like we could then go to this cinema. And when I was in high school, I think I started going to the cinema more. And for me, I think I found myself with an extra fascination with how actors end up portraying the characters who are so vastly different from them. And so I'd pretend to be Godzilla, and I pray to God to be Spider-Man, you know, and there's just so many silly things that I wanted as a kid. So it's interesting in hindsight that I realized that I did want to act for such a long time and want to be a storyteller. And so when I came to Brisbane to study my master's in marketing and international business, I finished and was working for a year and a half and can't sit in an office. I was like, it's not for me. And I really had to dig deep. I was like, what the hell do I want to do? And I'd forgotten all the childhood film stuff. Well, you know, I was still watching movies, but like, I just didn't think that acting was a thing. And I remember one of my workmates was like, yeah, you'd be an interesting like interviewer. You'd be like, I feel like if you had your own talk show, you'd be really cool at it. So maybe you should consider being a talk show host. I can see you on TV. And that kind of re-sparked that. I was like, I can see you on TV. And I was like, huh, what about an actor? Would you see me as an actor? And they were like, oh, fuck yeah. And I was like, So then I went to an audition for Oedipus Rex at UQ, University of Queensland, and butchered the worst. It was the worst audition I've ever given in my life. And then they cast me as a guard. And I started learning everything from what a beat was in their rehearsals. I'd watched them in their rehearsals and stayed longer because I was just a guard, so I wasn't needed for anything. Then I kind of bailed on the production when I'd learned enough. Started taking lessons and then auditioned for NIDA. But I'd done like a few courses and then got an agent, became an extra on a few jobs. And that's when I kind of decided whether I wanted to do it for money or fame or for the love of it. And I really needed to decide that for myself. And for me, it was for the love of it. If for any reason I found out that it was for the fame or money, I wouldn't have done it. I'd have cut it short and not done it. But the more challenges I got, the more I left jobs, like secure jobs to pursue casual jobs in order to do classes, and that difficulty of paying for these classes and everything, and the more fulfilled I was in just learning. And I felt like a kid at a candy store each time I was on a set, even as an extra. I was like, yeah, I really love the idea of, not the idea, but the art of telling stories. Then it started from there.
You're talking about watching films in Kenya. I'm curious what kind of films you're watching. Is there much of a Kenyan cinema? Is there stuff going on in Kenya? Is a cinematic language there?
Oh yeah, Kenyans love cinema. Kenyans love cinema. Kenyans love TV shows. A lot of, interestingly, I grew up watching Home and Away, Neighbors, Skippy the Bush Kangaroo back home. Like there were so many. We have this African company called DSTV that kind of offers like a lot of, and before that, we'd have like satellite dishes that would get an array of channels, and so did our like a privatized and public national channels would get a lot of channels that would show a lot of TV shows. So The Bold and the Beautiful in the US, a soap opera, Home and Away, Neighbors, Skippy the Bush Kangaroo, watched a lot of that. And telenovelas. Telenovelas are like so popular in Kenya. So popular in Kenya. So a lot of like Mexican shows, like are incredibly popular. So I think Kenyans just love being entertained, and cinemas do really well there. Watch a lot of American films, a lot of British films as well. So it's thriving. And now there's more TV shows there's a lot of Kenyan TV shows that are on Netflix as well. Yeah, so it's coming up. It's on the come up, yeah.
And then you're mentioning the decision when you're being an actor, whether it's for the love of the craft or for money. Why is that a big distinction for you? What was the important choice there of deciding that?
I think because of celebrity culture. I love watching films, but I see actors and the celebrity culture side of it, and I'm like, I don't think that's for me. It's not something I aspire to. I kind of like walking down the street, being able to be myself, walking to a store to buy bananas and just be myself, but walking down, like, buy groceries and you know, just be myself. And, you know, so for me, it was, I think the reason why I asked that of myself is I've also seen a lot of big actors suffer. You know, Robin Williams, you see, you know, Jim Carrey, you see a lot of people like suffer some sort of loneliness, some sort of mental health, and you get to see them turn to a crutch like drugs or alcohol or gambling or women, you know, or, you know, like if it's a woman, like men, or, you know, like it's so alcohol, same thing. There's always a crutch when there's that mental gap that hasn't been answered for an artist as to why they're doing what they do. It doesn't matter how popular you get or how rich you get. If that's not answered for yourself, something will have to fill that gap. And if you haven't answered it for yourself, a crutch is going to fill that. And whether that's substance abuse or overspending or anything. And at that level, when you're famous or whatever, it's accessible. People will tell you yes on every level. And it also, I feel like it also deters you from knowing who your close people are. You don't have a close circle because you're in it for the wrong reasons. So there's so many people trying to get to know you, you know. And everyone feels like you owe them. I always see this, and when you're in public, as not me, but like in terms of like celebrity culture, like, you know, I paid attention to, is like people feel like you owe them. You owe them an autograph or whatever. Like you have to take time to give them attention, which is it's great in some aspects, but sometimes it's a huge infringement on your privacy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this extension of having a parasocial relationship where, you know, we know so much about the person and this is the first time they're met that person. And it's like, exactly. I don't know who you are. I don't know what you are doing. You're talking about having a group and a circle behind you to support you.
Yeah.
Building that up in Australia, how did you go about that? How did you build that kind of connection? Was it people that you met at NIDA and continued to sustain a relationship onwards?
Yeah. Interestingly, yes. Yes. Yes and no. NIDA actually does play a huge part because I feel like a lot of my close friends who are not in the arts are still my close friends, yes. But I have a lot of new close friends from my experience at NIDA who then get the arts and are part of the arts. And you can talk about things that you usually cannot talk to anyone else about, right? And so I do have a small circle of friends in the industry and outside of the industry. I think it's so important because they're never going to lie to you. They're just not going to lie to you. They're not going to sugarcoat anything. They're just going to be like, this is the truth. This is what we feel. You know, this is who you're turning into, or this is who we admire that you keep being, you know. So I think people are important in terms of the relationships you foster, especially in this industry, because fame happens to be a byproduct of what we do. It's just a job. This is a job. It's like if a plumber, if plumbers got famous for whatever, you know what I mean? It's just so weird that it is so part of the job and so tied to success or the mainstream side of things. You know what I mean? Mm. So the fact that it's kind of, I don't want to say inevitable, because there are people who still navigate on a high level without much. And I love that kind of shit. I want to just work. I just want to work. Yeah. I just want to tell stories. But really, people knowing who I am. So if I can be as transformative as possible, great. People would recognize my face or whatever, you know.
Let's talk about doing, so you did a short and then you worked on some TV series as well. And I'm curious about what it was like getting to be on different kinds of productions to start off with. And that first day of walking on a set, whether it was a short or a series, and the realization of having done all the prep work, building up a character, and then, you know, now it's go. What was that like for you?
Man, it's always scary. I think it's always scary. It never really changes. I think what changes is your confidence in yourself. You know, from, I think every production has had its learning points, and every character teaches you something. Some harder to let go of than others, to be honest. But I think, yeah, every set is different, and every set on or even on a different country, working in Australia as opposed to working in the US is very different. But it's all very rewarding. I think the foundation again is knowing yourself, knowing why you do what you do. Because when you know that, the world can throw anything at you, but you'll be solid.
Like working on something like Bump, like that's a huge show.
Yeah,
it's massive.
Yeah,
what's that like? What's it like being part of something like that and getting swept along in the process of it?
And that was one of the scariest, because I was like, shit, this is my first gig. But everyone was so friendly, and I think I surprised myself, because I thought I did a shit job. And especially when you're playing a character who's kind of funny and quirky, one of the things that I had to learn for myself is that, yes, the crew will laugh in the first take, but after that, it doesn't mean it's not funny. It just means that they're doing their fucking job. Everyone's just doing their job. It doesn't mean it's any less funny. It's just that you're doing take after take after take after take, you know, and you don't rely on other people's laughter to gratify that you're doing well. As long as you're sticking to the character and their truth, then nothing else really matters. The story will come forward, whether it's supposed to be a comedy, supposed to be a horror, or supposed to be, yeah, an action film. As long as you're sticking to the character's true truth, then you're there. So I think Bump was a very good step in learning that just stick to the character. Everything else, you'll be nervous for sure. It'll be hard, but trust in your character. And when you have and find freedom in the character each and every time. Yeah.
It's comforting to hear you say that as well, about finding the character and knowing as well, if the crew's laughing on set the first time and then the second time they're not. For some people, there might be that switch of going, am I not funny anymore? And you were mentioning Robin Williams and Jim Carrey. These are iconic comedians. So with that in mind, and I'm curious about what comedy means for you as a creative person, and to be able to build a comedic profile. Is that something you aim to do?
I do. It's one of my biggest goals, to be honest, because I've never, and I'll say this in past tense now, I used to think I was not funny at all, but up until very recently, to be honest. And I kind of had to be like, to shut myself up and be like, don't put yourself down, because the more you do it, you kind of create the reality, you know, of your circumstances. If you keep saying you're not funny, you're eventually going to be not funny. But if you realize that, yes, like you do have funny choices in your range, and it all depends on what the script is giving you circumstantially or what the character is saying, then you just trust in yourself that when you really, like, some of my favorite comedy is situational comedy. And when you have a character who really digs into, like, the situation, and the stakes of it, it makes it hilarious. That's why I enjoyed Anora, watching Anora, because there were scenes that were so funny in the most tragic ways that even I was kind of judging myself for laughing. But I was like, fuck it, this is funny. It's funny. It's messed up, but it's funny. So I think comedy is something I've really grown to be comfortable with. And now I'm not afraid of a comedic scene or a comedic character, because what happened before, I used to self-sabotage. I'd be like, well, I have to play this funny because it's a comedy. But these days I'm like, a comedy is just like any other script. I just play the truth. And if I play the truth, the comedy will come out of it. You know, whether I like it or not, it's just, that's how it's written. You know, it was great with great writing. The comedy, just trust the comedy. I remember I did a callback for a show that I wish I could audition for now again. And I remember the showrunner was like, just say it. And he's American. He's like, just say it, man. Just say it. And I'm like, yeah, I'm saying it. In my head, I'm like, I'm saying it, I swear. But I think I was adding nuances of like, and it could be subtle. It's the subtle difference of like trying to be funny. It wasn't like overtly trying to be funny. It was just subtle trying to be funny. And that's the difference between great comedic timing and an actor just trying to be funny, you know? And I learned a lot from that.
It's a good kind of segue into talking about the two films that screened at Adelaide Film Festival.
Yeah.
I guess, which one came first? What did you shoot first?
Make It Look Real.
Okay. So let's start talking about it, because there is aspects of comedy in Make It Look Real, but I'm curious about how you came to the project. What was the process? Was there an audition process? And I guess I'd love to hear about, even before the audition process, I'd love to hear your description of what the film is as well.
Make It Look Real is a docu feature about intimacy coordination, and it follows the story of one intimacy coordinator, Claire Warden, who's a very well-known intimacy coordinator, and her journey into going into that industry and being one of the, you know, champions of that industry, in a sense, not industry, but like that craft. And then it goes into how a script goes from its inception from a director's standpoint, or writer-director in this case, with Kieran Darcy Smith, and then the discussion between an intimacy coordinator and the director and director-writer in terms of what the vision is and what is expected to come out of it, and then goes into how the cast take it and what their boundaries are. So that's the crux of the documentary feature, is how you come from the inception of a script, and then into discussing with the intimacy coordinator, with the director and writer, and then going into discussing with the actors into what is finally filmed as a final product, including everyone's boundaries, the vision. So it's very fascinating, because I think it's very needed, because a lot of people always ask me, how do you shoot sex scenes? Do people actually have sex? I'm like, no, that would be a porn movie.
Yeah.
You know? You know? And it's the most unsexy thing that is possible. And everyone keeps like, they can't get it. So they're like, but you're shooting a sex scene. How is that not sexy? You know? And it's just like a fight scene. I always use the analogy of a fight scene, because it's the same thing, kind of the same thing. Anyway, so that's the crux of the film. And
the audition process. I'm then curious about how you came to the film.
Yeah, it was more like I was approached about it, because the producers saw me in a short, an actor's short film. And I guess liked it, and then approached my managers and were like, would Albert be willing to do this? And I was like, this is great. This is very needed. Like, it's something that I've never experienced, and I've never shot a documentary. The hardest thing is playing myself, is being myself, because I'm not even playing myself. I'm just being myself. It's so weird. Anyway, but yeah, that's how that came about in a sense. Yeah.
I'm then curious, because as you mentioned, there's like three layers of it. There's the documentary aspect, which Kate is running, and then you've got Kieran as well. And then you've got the whole process of the intimacy coordination. So is it almost like three different layers of direction, for want of a better term? How do you navigate that as a director, as an actor?
I'd say it's more of two different levels of directing, because the Kate Blackmore is kind of like the fly on the wall. You know, she's just filming the background of it. So she's filming us being ourselves, being silly and all that, and the process it takes. But then when you're then filming, it's kind of, you're taking direction on a technical side from Claire, the intimacy coordinator. And then you're taking direction from which technical side does help with character, in terms of, because what is fascinating about intimacy coordination is Claire Warden is researching what the character's feeling in every moment that then informs their movement, which is the same way as, you know, that's why I keep comparing to a stunt, because the stunt coordinator also has to look at the character's point of view, being like, okay, this character feels betrayed at this point, so they kind of see red and blah, 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 and that's why their movements are more staccato and erratic, as opposed to very thought through, right? So they'll be, you know, it's just the same way a sound coordinator will be able to explain to an actor. That's why you kind of technically have to be a bit more erratic with your movements. That's the same way an intimacy coordinator will be able to tell an actor, in this point, you know, maybe be more sensual, because, you know, as we discussed in the table read, this is what the character is feeling, and they're going off what you've offered. What you've offered, what the director's offered. So they're not trying to infringe or change anything. They're just reminding you that, you remember you said, like, this is what you feel. So, you know, this is where you could adjust it in this way, or if you want, you know. And then the director will give you, you know, Kieran will give you direction on character. More character related instances, but they still both influence character.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I find it so fascinating. Like, it is such a, as you're saying, it's not something that has really been explored or discussed in a documentary format before, or really on screen. For me, having watched it a couple of times now, I'm like, there is pre make it look real, and then there's post make it look real. And it was fascinating to be able to watch some films at the Adelaide Film Festival, having seen Make It Look Real, and then I watched specifically I'm thinking of Went Up the Hill, which is a film that is this beautifully shot film, but it has this quite pivotal sex scene in it. And all I kept thinking was, because there's this scene in Make It Look Real where you're discussing, you know, you're asked about how much of your body are you comfortable in showing. Yeah. And effectively, it's this comic moment, but it's dealt with a very serious manner. Where you're looking at going, well, actually, it's only this part, right? This section. And then I was watching
the bottom half of my butt cheek.
Yeah, exactly.
So funny.
And then I was watching Went Up the Hill, and it's like, I couldn't help but focus on how much of the actor's body that we got to see, and the machinations and the place where their legs or their arms are. And it's like, oh, there must have been that same kind of negotiation process. And granted, not all films do, but have, or, you know, implement an intimacy coordinator, but I know for that one they did. But it's just this case of, you know, negotiating and discussing and all this kind of stuff. It's a long-winded way of saying, is the same process for you, this pre-make it look real and post-make it look real, is that something that you've experienced having been part of the film and also having seen the film as well, knowing, like, has it changed your mind as an actor?
It's made me respect just the process a bit more. You know, I've always respected the process, but it really, truly has made me respect the process more, because and we're talking about like intimate scenes where it's like on a positive side. Now imagine where it's on a negative side, like, you know, and I was talking to my scene partner about a film, The Nightingale, you know, and we were just talking about, because this masterclass is about intimacy as well. So, you know, I'm still working on the craft of being able to get comfortable in situations where they kind of ask for, you know, for a lot of the character, whether it's vulnerability in a scene that's either sexual or intimate, or just the physicality of it, you know. And so we're talking about The Nightingale, and there's a scene, man, there's a rape scene that was really just, I remember watching that, and I was like, it really affected me. I was like, holy shit, this is insane. So to me, I was like, how did they film that? How did they talk to these? How did they make it such a safe space? And like that intimacy coordinator I'd have loved to see the behind the scenes of how they had those discussions, you know? So it's made me respect the process a lot, because it, for you to get a story that strong, there has to be a strong process of trust and respect and very meticulous detail. You know what I mean? So it's made me respect the process a lot more, even though I still have this much respect, you know, a lot. Yeah.
Well, with that in mind as well, like, you've got Tom, you've got Sarah in the film that you're working alongside. What kind of relationship, we see your relationship as actors kind of flourish and grow in the documentary, but I'm curious about the process for you on and off camera, what that was like to be able to work collectively with two other people who are going through the same experience that you are.
It was fascinating. It's fascinating because, like, we were all nervous and uncomfortable, but like, we all eventually got there. And some, like, naturally, some people are going to be more comfortable than others. I think for all of us, it was really sticking to our own individual boundaries and not being swayed by someone's comfort or discomfort. It's sticking to your guns. And if then you get more comfortable then on set, then you can then open up a bit more or take a boundary away that you were previously uncomfortable with, you know. So pre and post, I think it's just been a very beautiful friendship amongst the three of us. And at first, you know, we're all kind of getting to know each other, and you see it in the documentary, you see it as it progresses. We kind of get more comfortable with each other, and we're able to like share more, and even now we have a group chat on Instagram where we talk to each other and, you know, and constantly keep in contact. So it's been really beautiful to maintain a friendship amongst the three of us, and also go through our own journeys, our own individual journeys, but then a collective journey together.
I mentioned the comedy of the film as well earlier, and I want to stress, anybody listening to this, it's not a comedy. Like, it's not a laugh out loud minute comedy, but there are moments of comedy in there. And specifically, I'm talking about, you know, again, that negotiation of how much of the body you're comfortable in putting on screen. But then also there's an oral sex scene where we get to see, as you're saying, like, there is nothing sexy about it, right? But the machinations of it and the guidance that Claire gives you in that moment is so fascinating, right? And I'm curious if you can talk about that experience of learning how to act that way on screen.
Yeah, it's one of the most interesting things I think people ask me is, because you kissed a guy, are you bi? And I'm like, I've been asked that so many times. I'm like, that is the funniest, weirdest question. I'm like, from seeing that, that's the one thing you thought of asking. And I always ask people, whenever they ask me that, I'm always like, okay, if I play a character who's a killer, does that mean I, as Albert, I'm a killer? And they're like, no. And I'm like, well, then does that mean I'm bisexual just because you've seen me kiss a guy on screen as a character? And they're like, well, I'm like, why don't you get the point? I just used the most clear analogy. You know what I mean? So, but yeah, I find that very fascinating when people ask that. Because like, I'm straight, I'm heterosexual.
Yeah.
And I don't judge anyone for their sexual preference, right? But if I'm, and at the same time, if I'm playing a character who's gay, I want to play the character, I'm playing the character. It's a character. It's like actors play policemen or policewomen or plumbers, and I bring back the plumber. And they're not plumbers or policemen or policewomen. So how is that different when it comes to a sexual orientation for people to grasp? You know what I mean? So I just always find that fascinating. But but in terms of the process, it's scary. You know, it's scary. But for me, I always go back to what's my character feeling at this point. You know, and in the case of Make It Look Real, he's trying to save their marriage, and he's trying to do it in she's challenging him with a male escort, and he's like, and she's like, you never take challenges, you're never adventurous. So he's like, well, and he's, don't forget, he's under the influence of a lot of vodka and cocaine. So he's trying to impress his wife, he's trying to do everything he can to save the marriage, so he'll make out with the male escort, and you know. And I think somewhere deep inside there, he's surprised that it's not as bad as he thought. You know what I mean? And I think when Tom's character goes down on him, you know, he's like, what the fuck? It's, you know, and it's like, stops it. And it's like, that, to him, that's like, okay, now we've gone kind of too far.
Well, I wasn't even thinking of that one. I was thinking of the scene that with between yourself and Sarah, and the slight shifts of the head. You know, you're just going up and down, up and down.
Yeah.
Right. And the moment of that is like, it the illusion, right? The illusion of what's actually going on, and that is, in itself is fascinating.
It is so fascinating. It truly is, and to us, it's hilarious because we're not. It looks, and that's the beauty about camera work. It looks like we're really doing it. It really does look like we're doing it, but it's like so far from it, which is very fascinating. It's so far from it. Like people would assume that genitals touch. It's like nowhere close, nowhere close. We have modesty garments. We don't even, like we anchor ourselves on like in the case of the kitchen scene, like my outer thighs are anchored on her inner thighs, so our pelvis never touch. So we use those as anchor points to make sure we don't go in, like it doesn't go any further. But we have modesty garments and everything, so nothing's ever gonna happen that involves any contact. But just for everyone's comfort, the anchor points keep you grounded in, and you can play from there. Like when you have your, you have that strong contact between the outer thigh and her inner thighs, then it's so easy to, even if the scene took it to a place where I carried her off from the counter, you know, you still use those anchor points. So nothing ever happens that makes anyone uncomfortable. Yeah.
So let's shift over to talking about With or Without You, which is...
Yes. Yeah.
Film that I found so unexpected. I thought it would be good going in, but I found myself so completely moved by it. What's the experience like getting the script for a film like that, and knowing that your character is such a vital part of it, and also possibly knowing the history that it's taken so long to get into action? What was that like for you?
For me, I just treated it like any other script. I always just focus on my character's point of view and my character's relationship to other people's point of views, and the arc of the whole story and my character's place in it. And so, you know, there was a lot of discussions with Kelly about point of view and, you know, intentions of the character and backstory. What I loved about that is there was a lot of collaboration. And, you know, the script did change here and there, like every script does, same as Make It Look Real. It changes. And it always changes because there's collaboration. And it always changes for the better. You know, so it was, I think it was, and handling, you know, aside from the fact that, you know, it's been a 14-year journey for her. For me, I understand that, yes, it's her baby, but I never want to compromise my own artistry because of that, you know. So I always approach every script with care, whether someone has written it for a year or 3 months or, you know, I always approach it with care because it's someone's art. And if I don't gel with the art, I'm not going to do it. But if I gel with the art and there's something I relate to, then I'm drawn to it. And, you know, it's always a discussion. It's always a discussion. So I really respect that Kelly collaborated just like everyone else on from the cast to the crew. Everyone was very collaborative. Everyone sacrificed something. Everyone compromised. Man, that was 22 locations, you know, in 5 weeks. It's a tough ask for everyone, you know. So I think everyone really pulled through, and it shows. It really shows in the film.
What I was really impressed by as well is that often these kinds of stories, they focus on one character and then the peripheral characters kind of feed into that one main character, right? But with Chloe, with Sharon, with Dalu, all three of those characters are their own main character in a way. And each one, yes, does feed into the other, but if we were just to follow Dalu's story, it would still be as compelling. And I'm curious what that meant to you to be able to see that, you know, these three characters are effectively the three leads, and that it could be any one of their story that we're following.
Yeah, honestly, and hats off to Kelly for her writing, because like it's really hard. I always find it hard to make more characters central. You know what I mean? Like to make an ensemble like that central to a narrative is very fascinating, because it's essentially a mother-daughter story, but it's also a love story. And the fact that they sit so interestingly and fit together like a beautifully put together jigsaw puzzle is, you know, a testament to the writing and like I said, collaboration, everyone being on the same page. Not that it was easy to make for everyone. It's not easy. No project is ever easy, but when you have people coming together, having discussions, having arguments as well, you know, it's good. It's good because it really, let no one tell you that there's a production that's done without some form of conflict. There's always conflict, you know. We're human beings. We all have differences in opinion, and conflict always creates a form of understanding and perspective shift, you know, for both parties, you know. So yeah, grateful for the team, because no one does it alone, you know. Yeah.
And then for you as an actor, getting to see both of them have their premieres at Adelaide Film Festival, like, it's got to be quite the experience. What was that like?
That was hectic, man. I didn't know for a while that Make It Look Real was going to premiere at the Adelaide Film Festival. I don't think it sat in me that I had two premieres. I was like, what? And I think it was Matt Kesting who kind of like was like, you got two. And I'm like, oh shit, I got two. You know? But it's very fascinating, because I think what I loved about that is that it's a capacity for audiences to see me in two different projects, very different projects, and see me play two very different characters. And hopefully it resonated with them in each project's capacity. But that's what was fascinating about it. I think that it's great exposure, and I got to, what I loved about it as well is that I got to talk to so many filmmakers and see their projects and be a fan of their projects, and then to hear them compliment me was like, holy shit. I was like, oh wow, like I'm doing the right thing. Like I'm doing, like I'm actually, I feel like I'm living the dream that I've always set out to be. It's, to, for me, it was just to tell stories authentically and to just do it if I can consistently, because this industry is in and out of employment and unemployment.
Yeah, you know? Which is its own precarious thing. It's hard to, yeah. You know, it's hard. We won't obviously go into that, but I'm curious, did you sit around and watch both of those films? Were you there in the audience with them?
Hell yeah, both films. I think With or Without You, I ended up watching twice because the Q&A was on a separate day. Make It Look Real was the second time I was watching it because we watched it here in Sydney a few months back. Where we had a screening for us, the cast and the crew. So it was really lovely to see it again and hear audiences' reactions and have my own cringe moments, and I'm like, oh, I'm self-conscious. But it's just natural. I loved it. Yeah.
Where to next for you? It's kind of alluded to before, comedy is something you're interested in exploring, but is there a kind of, do you have a career path in mind? What do you want to actually do as an actor? Is it TV? Is it film, swapping between the two?
Great question. I am very much looking forward to being back on stage. So I'm back on stage next year at the Ensemble Theatre in Kirribilli here in Sydney. For a very beautiful script, a just amazing script the story called Primary Trust by Ebony Booth, who's an American writer, and she just won the Pulitzer Prize for that last year, I think. I hope I got it right, got that right. But it's a fantastic script, fantastic director, Darren Yap. I'm very, very excited. It's a whole different feeling being on stage and coming up in front of an audience, you know, and my character addresses the audience for a certain chunk of the play, which I love that challenge. And I've been in one play before where I addressed the audience, and that scared the living shit out of me at that time. But now having been through that, and I conquered that, which is great. Having been through that was amazing. So I'm more excited than nervous to do it again in a different capacity. So that's in it for me. But in terms of like what I aspire for, I would love to be my next, I told my managers this, that my dream next is to get a musical, you know, a musical. And watching Emilia Perez was like fascinating to me, because to me, that's like exactly what I want, because that's like the stage and screen meeting together. Like that was phenomenal, and that if I got something like that, that's just like a dream, a complete dream. So a musical, I want to play a villain really badly, or someone who's just a misunderstood character, whether their circumstances lead them to that or they choose to be like that. I would love to, because I feel like it'd be an interesting challenge, because finding the reason why people become who they are is the most interesting thing about this craft. And a villain would be a massive challenge to pursue. Someone who's seen as a villain, you know. And yeah, so very excited for that. If I get a chance to, but I will. I'm just manifesting that stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I see a long career ahead for you. I'm not a fortune teller, but you're very comfortable on screen, and it's always a, you know, in the two films that I've seen, and of course in Bump and stuff like that, it's been great to see you grow and build and change, and the different kind of forms that you're building together. Usually I
thank end, you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Like, it's been a delight to be able to sit down and talk with you as well. But usually I kind of wrap up these conversations asking filmmakers what it means to be an Australian filmmaker working in Australia and telling Australian stories. But I guess for you, the question is a little bit different. What does it mean to be a Kenyan storyteller telling stories in Australia? Do you want to bring the Kenyan stories to Australia, or the Kenyan energy to Australia? Is there, you know, what do you want to do in that kind of aspect?
Yeah. You know, I think I want to, like, I'm just starting off a journey in writing, and I want to direct as well, because I it's really good watching 16 films and seeing how differently they're directed, and documentaries included, watching how differently they're directed. And whenever I get a chance to ask questions of the director of what their point of view is and why they chose certain shots, is fascinating for me, because I eventually want to direct. And I, every time I help a friend with an audition, I find I'm getting better at in a sense directing for story. And so it's something I'm kind of just fostering and brewing on my own, and I think when the right opportunity comes with the right story, I look forward to directing. And yeah, so there's lots of storytelling journeys that I feel like I'm opening up for myself slowly, and I just keep daring to dream and putting myself out there. It's an exciting time, and I do want to bring a Kenyan side to it. I would love to play a Kenyan character soon, and I think, you know, I think the next character I get, I'm going to try and put in some Swahili in there and represent my country a bit more. And even I'm going back to Kenya in end of this month, so I want to interact with a few industry professionals there, whether they be directors, writers, cinematographers, just to like see what's going on, and just be on set and take notes and shadow people and just learn. I think Australia has been amazing, and I keep learning so much, and I want to bring a Kenyan side. I feel like the right story will come. There's something I'm writing that I'm very excited. It's just an interesting story. It doesn't have to be necessarily a Kenyan story, but I feel like the character is a Kenyan in Australia, but it's a very weird story, I find, and it's I'm very excited to see what will come out of it.
I love weird. Bring on the weird. But also bring on the Kenyan-Australian co-productions. Let's do that. Like, that would be exciting. You know, I'd love to see happen out of that. Yeah.
And there's so many Kenyans here. There's so many stories, so many Kenyan stories. So I look forward to having collaborating more and more between Kenya and Australia.
Over the past few years, we've started to see more cultural diversity on screen through the people who are telling the stories. And I greatly appreciate that, because a lot of the stories in Australia are migrant stories. And getting to hear that from the migrants themselves, or from people who are, you know, they might have become, you know, like their family might have been a migrant in the past or whatever, and they're second or third generation Australians. And I find that fascinating, that finally, after all this time, we're actually getting to hear these stories on screen. And that's part of the reason why I'm like, well, we hardly get to hear any Kenyan stories on screen in Australia. And I'm like, well, you know, let's tap into that. You know, I'd love to hear. As you're saying, there's a lot of Kenyans. And certainly, like, I live in Perth, and we've got a vibrant Kenyan community here. And it's like, you know, it's just, they exist. Let's hear them.
Yeah. And honestly, like, a lot of these stories are like, I feel like it doesn't have to be like explained as a Kenyan story. It can just be like, you know, like an existing person in society. You know, I think a lot of times a tendency can be sometimes to portray the migrant story, you know, or the you know, and I think it's going to be refreshing to see more and more of just characters who exist in Australian society who have Australian friends, and they just like, it's a day-to-day kind of thing, and whatever that story is aiming to achieve or trying to tell, those characters just happen to be there, just like Australian societies, you know. So I look forward to more and more evolution of these stories, to show people as they just are and how they've been, because there are people who've been here for so many years. Some people don't even have Kenyan accents, or some people don't have Ghanaian accents, or whether they're from Ethiopia, they're, you know, so wherever, even from China, some people don't have the accents, or, you know, so it's always fascinating when it's just authentically true, you know, and whether it is a migrant story, it, you know, that has its own truth, but also there's also the day-to-day stuff that has its own truth. So there's capacity for a lot of different people, Australian or not, to exist on screen and on the stage. So I look forward to it, because I feel like Australia's film industry and TV industry is just growing. It's growing, and I find that we're separating ourselves more from trying to be like the US and the UK, and just being authentically ourselves, because we do have a culture, and, you know, and yeah, even First Nation people, you know, we all have a culture, and I think it's important that we keep showing ourselves as we are, even the difficult shit, you know, whether it's the difficult shit or the good shit, you know, show both sides, whether it's tragic or not, show it, be unapologetic. And I think that's what I look forward to with young filmmakers. I can't wait to watch Lesbian Space Princess, because I feel like I've just heard it so unapologetically itself, you know, and that's what I love. You cannot, no one can shy away from truth. When truth is told as the truth of what it is and not trying to be anything else, it's hard for even the biggest hater or whatever political side anyone's leaning, it's hard for them not to enjoy it. It truly is, you know. So to more truth, I say cheers to more truth.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
Albert, it's been wonderful to be able to talk with you. Thank you so much. You've been generous with your time, and you know, talking about your craft as well. Like, it's a delight. I really enjoyed it, and love getting to see you on screen again. I'm excited to see where you go from here.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you. This has been awesome. I loved this, and I appreciate it. Thank you for reaching out, and this was awesome. You haven't taken my time. We've just had an amazing conversation, and I look forward to more conversations in the future, man. Honestly.
That is Albert Mwangi talking about his work on Make It Look Real, With or Without You, in theatre, and a lot more. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. To help keep track of his work, make sure to visit Albert's Instagram profile, which I'll stick a link in the show notes. And to also check out other interviews on The Curb, visit thecurb.com.au. We will see you on the next one.